The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're getting into a really significant, maybe even controversial book from the last few decades, Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth, which came out back in 1990.
Yeah, it's more than just a book, really. It feels almost like a cultural diagnosis. And honestly, for anyone trying to make sense of today's world, you know, with social media filters, constant selfies, endless anti-aging ads, this deep dive feels pretty essential.
Absolutely. And our goal here is to try and understand this, well, this deep paradox that Wolf pointed out years ago, but which seems even more relevant now.
You mean the fact that women, particularly in the West, have made these huge leaps forward legally, economically, socially?
Exactly. Unprecedented freedom, really. But at the same time, why do so many women feel more anxious, more insecure, more fixated on achieving some kind of physical perfection than ever? Doesn't quite add up, does it?
It really doesn't. And Wolf's argument just cuts straight through that idea that it's, oh, just vanity. She says, no, this obsession isn't natural. It's not innate. It's actually a system.
A system? How so?
A commercially driven one, she argues. A kind of sophisticated social control mechanism that acts as a backlash against women's progress. It keeps us focused on our flaws psychologically and economically instead of, you know, our power.
Okay, that's a powerful claim. Let's maybe unpack the author herself first. Who is Naomi Wolf? What gave her this particular insight?
Well, she had the academic credentials, definitely Yale, Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. But what's really striking, I think, is her age when this book just exploded onto the scene. She was only 28.
Wow, 28. To publish something that shifts the cultural conversation like that, that takes some serious guts and insight.
It really does. And it kind of positioned her perfectly as this voice of what people call third wave feminism.
Yeah.
See, she wasn't necessarily fighting the same battles her mother's generation fought in the 60s and 70s for, like, basic legal rights.
Right. Many of those were, at least on paper, largely won by then.
Exactly. So she was dealing more with the sort of cultural fallout, the lived reality after the legal victories.
So she's part of that first generation growing up with the promise of equality, the idea you can have it all. But then she hits the real world and experiences this intense, almost crushing pressure about appearance. That gap between the promise and the reality must have been really stark.
Yeah, apparently blindingly obvious to her and her peers. So she had this academic background, but also this direct lived experience. It let her see it not just as, like, individual women feeling bad about themselves, but as a political and economic system at work.
She was really one of the first to connect those dots systematically, wasn't she? To show how culture could undermine freedom from the inside.
Precisely. Okay, so let's talk about that core premise.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a backlash, what's the central argument of the beauty myth?
Well, the main thrust is that this whole concept of beauty isn't just about aesthetics. It's a manufactured social idea, basically designed to keep existing power structures, specifically patriarchal ones, in place.
Right. As women gained more power politically, economically, the standards for how they should look got way, way stricter and narrower. It's like the myth stepped in when overt discrimination became less acceptable.
It became a new form of control, just quieter, more internalized.
Exactly. And the metaphor she uses for this ideal is, frankly, terrifying, the Iron Maiden.
Yeah, and we should be clear, that's not meant as a compliment, right?
Not at all. It's named after that medieval torture device, the spiked coffin. Wolf uses it to represent this rigid, inescapable, idealized image of female beauty, you know, forever young, weightless, flawless.
An image that's completely impossible to actually achieve or maintain.
By design. That's the point. The modern Iron Maiden is psychological torture. The spikes are self-doubt, self-criticism.
And its function is basically to keep women busy, right?
Yeah.
Channeling all that energy, time, and money into chasing this impossible ideal.
Absolutely. It keeps women preoccupied. You might have the legal right to run for office, but if a huge chunk of your mental space and resources are tied up in worrying about wrinkles or weight, well, you're still tethered, aren't you?
It's a very effective form of control because it makes women police themselves and each other. So, Wolf then breaks down how this myth works in different areas. Work, culture, dieting, sex, even violence. Let's dig into that, maybe starting with work. That feels incredibly relevant today.
Definitely. She coined this term, the professional beauty qualification, or PBQ. It's that unwritten requirement, isn't it? That powerful appearance-based standard for women in jobs especially if they moved into more male-dominated fields.
Oh, absolutely. You see it everywhere. Appearance becomes this subtle but really potent form of, well, discrimination. It Right. creates hierarchies.
And think about the economic cost. Wolf calls it the beauty tax. All the money women spend on makeup, hair, clothes, procedures, just to be seen as professional or even just acceptable.
It's huge. It drains resources, reduces financial independence, and crucially, it feeds the very industries that profit from making women feel like they need fixing in the first place.
It's a perfect feedback loop for those industries, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Cosmetics, diet, surgery, they rely on that self-doubt.
And the media plays a massive role here, obviously. Wolf calls it the propaganda arm.
Yeah.
Just relentless images of digitally perfected bodies, usually young, thin, white, symmetrical.
Which creates this massive gap between the ideal and, well, reality for almost everyone. And that gap is where the insecurity and the profit lies.
Okay, so moving from the workplace and media, Wolf also makes these really interesting, maybe unexpected connections between the beauty myth and things like religion and hunger.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the argument. Mm. She suggests the beauty myth kind of functions like a secular religion, especially as traditional religion declined for some. It provides a moral framework.
A moral framework. How does that work?
Well, think about it. The body becomes this temple that needs constant purification. Dieting is framed like fasting, denying the flesh for a higher goal, which is thinness. Aging is treated almost like a sin you have to atone for, maybe through cosmetic procedures.
Ah, I see. So pursuing beauty gets loaded with this moral weight, like being good or virtuous.
Exactly. It controls behavior by making appearance a moral issue. And that ties directly into hunger and dieting. Wolf's phrase for dieting is just brutal. She calls it a political tranquilizer.
Wow. A political tranquilizer. What does she mean by that?
Her argument is that keeping women perpetually hungry or obsessed with food and weight does a few things. It makes them physically weaker, sure, but also mentally preoccupied. Less energy to focus on bigger ambitions, career, politics, changing the world.
It keeps them small, literally and figuratively. Docile.
Pretty much. She even links historical moments like when women's power surged in the 80s with a cultural shift towards demanding even thinner bodies. It's like a subconscious societal pushback.
As ambition expands, the pressure to shrink intensifies. That's chilling.
It really is. Now, we should probably touch on the parts of the book that stirred up maybe the most debate, her analysis of sex and violence.
Right. On sex, she argues the myth kind of replaces genuine, active female desire with something more performative, like appearance-based.
Yeah, the cultural ideal often pushes this image of passive, doll-like desirability. And if a woman is constantly worried about how she looks during sex, is she really present? Is she focused on her own pleasure?
It encourages being looked at rather than being an active participant, a spectator in your own experience.
Exactly. And then there's the violence chapter, which is very provocative. She looks at the boom in cosmetic surgery and frames it not just as consumer choice, but as a form of culturally accepted violence against women's bodies.
How does she make that case?
She argues the myth takes normal features, wrinkles, body fat, signs of aging, and turns them into flaws or deformities that need correcting through invasive, often painful procedures.
So the industry profits by pathologizing normality, convincing women their natural bodies are wrong.
Precisely. Now that does bring up a tricky point, doesn't it? What about agency? If a woman chooses surgery, is it fair to call it violence? Doesn't that take away her choice?
That's the big counter argument, yeah.
And Wolf acknowledges that tension. She's not saying individual choice doesn't exist, but she asks us to look at the context. When so much jobs, relationships, social acceptance seems to depend on conforming to this narrow ideal, how truly free is that choice?
It's more like a constrained choice, maybe, a choice made under immense pressure.
That's closer to her point, I think. The pressure makes invasive procedures feel almost necessary rather than just one option among many.
Okay, that reframing helps. So let's try and boil this down. What are the absolute core messages we should take away from the beauty myth?
I think the first, the absolute foundation, is beauty standards are political. They aren't just about aesthetics. They're tools of social control. They divert women's energy and focus.
Right. Second, and this is crucial, insecurity is profitable. We have to recognize that huge industries depend on women feeling inadequate. Their business model is built on our self-doubt.
Third, this idea of pathologizing the female body. The myth turns normal things like aging or having curves into medical problems needing fixing. That gives the myth a kind of fake scientific authority.
Yeah, it makes it harder to challenge. And finally, that point we just discussed, the myth of free choice. We need to question how free choices about appearance really are when the social and economic stakes for conforming are so high.
Wolf's writing is just so sharp, too. She has some lines that really stick with you.
Definitely. Should we share a couple of those?
Let's do it. This first one nails the thinness obsession. A culture fixated on female thinness is not an obsession about female beauty, but an obsession about female obedience. Dieting is the most potent political sedative in women's history. A quietly mad population is a tractable one.
Oof. Yeah. That completely reframes the personal struggle with dieting as something much bigger and more political. It's about keeping women manageable.
And here's another, about what the myth is really asking for. The beauty myth is always prescribing behavior and not appearance. It is asking women to subscribe to a set of beliefs and behaviors that will keep them in their place.
So it's less about looking a certain way and more about acting a certain way compliant, focused on the superficial.
Exactly. Finally, her use of that core metaphor. The Iron Maiden was a medieval torture instrument. The modern Iron Maiden is an instrument of psychological torture. It just drives home how cruel and damaging this unattainable ideal actually is.
Okay, so this is all quite heavy. How do we take this awareness and actually apply it? What are the real life takeaways for listeners?
Well, the first big one has to be critical media consumption. Really look at the images you see. Ask yourself, who made this? Who profits if I feel bad comparing myself to this? Is this even real? Recognizing the filters, the Photoshop, the staging that builds resilience.
That's huge. Becoming a conscious consumer of media, not just passive.
Definitely. Second, try to actively reclaim health and wellness. Shift your focus from appearance goals, losing weight, fighting aging, to genuine well-being. Exercise, because it makes you feel strong. Eat to nourish yourself, not just to shrink.
Yeah, disconnect health from just looking a certain way.
Yeah.
In the workplace.
Being aware of that PBQ, that professional beauty qualification, allows you to consciously push back. Focus on your skills, your achievements. Measure your worth by your contributions, not just how well you perform looking the part. And maybe even call out lookism when you see it.
That takes courage, but it's important.
And finally, Wolf talks about personal liberation through beauty civil disobedience, basically just rejecting the myth's demands, reclaiming your body as, you know, yours, a home to live in, not a project that's never finished.
So reflecting on all this, what surprised you most or what really stuck with you from revisiting Wolf's work?
For me, it's probably how clearly she articulates that backlash theory, the idea that the beauty pressure intensified because feminism was succeeding. It makes the whole thing feel less random, more, well, strategic. It wasn't just fashion changing.
Yeah, that clicked for me too. And I think my biggest takeaway is just how empowering it feels to understand that these anxieties we often internalize about our bodies, about aging, they aren't personal failings.
Right, they're part of a larger political and economic system.
Exactly. And just knowing that, just seeing the Iron Maiden for the construct it is, that feels like the first real step toward freeing yourself from it. It shifts the blame from the individual to the system.
It really does. And it leaves you with Wolf's lingering provocative question, doesn't it? If the beauty myth just vanished tomorrow, all the time, the money, the mental energy we pour into it, what would you actually do with all that reclaimed energy?
Something to think about. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.